is In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle on News Talk 760 WJR, presented by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne.
Another Sunday afternoon. We're so glad you could join us here on In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle on WJR. Rochelle called away on assignment this week, so we're going to miss her, but we have a jam-packed show for you nonetheless. This past week, Rochelle wrote a wonderful article about DPS and how the mayor is making some overtures that he may step into the DPS schools and perhaps put his imprint on managing the schools. So we thought we'd talk a little bit about that today on In the Mix. And joining us is Keith Johnson, the retired Detroit Federation of Teachers president. Keith, thank you for joining us today on In the Mix.
Good afternoon, Marie. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, what a thorny topic we picked to open the show today, DPS, Detroit Public Schools. And you have an intimate knowledge of what goes on in the schools. Very quickly, just give me your first impression, if you can, about the mayor joining in and perhaps taking over some management of DPS.
Well, I'm certainly happy that the mayor wishes to get engaged. I don't support him having any management responsibility, but I do certainly appreciate and welcome him having a seat at the table, because the future of Detroit education and the city of Detroit are inextricably linked.
Could DPS be dismantled? We'll talk about that when we come back here on In the Mix. In the Mix here on WJR, Keith Johnson, our guest, retired Detroit Federation of Teachers president. Rochelle Riley, on assignment this week, but lucky enough, we have an article that she left for us from this past week on DPS and perhaps the mayor joining in on helping to solve some of the very tough problems facing the Detroit public school system. And Keith Johnson, of course, having spent many years in the Detroit public school system, has some deep insight into what's going on within the school system. In Rochelle's article, Keith, you mentioned that you're very fearful of one thing, and that's the possibility that the entire Detroit public school system could be dismantled. Can you tell us about that? I mean, it almost seems impossible to think about that.
Well, you're right. And really, my perspective was based upon the worst-case scenario. When you look at the fact that we'll just deal with the time since Detroit has been under an emergency manager, our deficit has continued to grow. We now pay about $53 million in debt service out of our state per pupil allocation towards the debt service. That represents 15% of our operating budget. And then when you compound that with the fact that 12% of our operating budget goes towards facilitating the needs of our children with special needs, it makes it virtually impossible for DPS to climb out of its deficit. And then you compound that with the fact that there seems to be a general sense of apathy relative to Detroit public schools from the lawmakers across the state. While they all agree that Detroit should have good quality education, they do not feel that the state has any culpability in the district's current financial dilemma, which, quite frankly, was created under state oversight. So I think that when you look at this perpetual deficit situation that we're in and no sense of urgency in order to relieve it, my fear is that ultimately the powers that be will say, well, you know, as Representative Kelly said back in June, well, just let DPS become dissolved. And if that begins to gain momentum, then I think you'll find less receptiveness to taking the measures that are necessary to help Detroit recover from this financial disaster created by the state.
And knowing the climate up in Lansing these days, that might just fall on some receptive ears.
Exactly. And you know, to that end, I'm glad that we have an ally on the coalition like John Ricolta, who is definitely respected, particularly throughout the Republican Party. And when someone like John Ricolta says, listen, you know, the state is the one that was the architect of this current financial situation that Detroit is in, and I'm not saying it was intentional, But the fact of the matter is there are some structural defects within DPS that create this financial dilemma. And as I have said before, Marie, if Bill Gates were to come and write a $400 million check to DPS today, but yet we refuse to address those structural deficiencies, within 3 years we'd be right back in the same situation. So it's not just a matter of financial recovery. It's also a matter of structural redesign.
And the mayor, we should also say that the mayor told Rochelle in this particular article that he said he doesn't want to and will not run the schools, but he is lobbying legislators to pay the school's deficit, run up under the emergency manager, and to let him appoint this a Detroit Education Commission to oversee two sets of schools to educate the kids, the new DPS school system and then this loose network of charter schools. You know, I have to ask you, what do you think about this concept of these two separate school systems? I mean, right now we have DPS and EAA. So what are your thoughts about having these? I find it confusing. I can't imagine being a parent in the system.
Well, first of all, let's look at EAA. EAA has been an abject failure, despite the best efforts of those who are working with EAA. But the fact of the matter is that the students who are enrolled in the schools under EAA have the same set of intrinsic inhibitors to learning that they had when those schools were part of DPS. I think that the mayor's concept of having a central body that is responsible for looking at education standards throughout the city of Detroit is really one that makes sense, because one of our concerns in DPS has been that there hasn't been any direct accountability and monitoring of the progress or lack of same of our charters as there is with our traditional public schools. So the concept of having an oversight body that would have responsibility for monitoring, for establishing standards and making sure that those standards are met, whether you're in a charter or whether you're in traditional DPS, really makes some sense. But along with that, you have to make sure that either entity is adequately equipped with the resources and wraparound services that are necessary in order to address those inhibitors to learning, whether they are social, whether they are cultural, whether they are physical and mental, or whether they are indeed academic. Because we have to have a comprehensive and holistic approach to addressing the educational needs of the children of Detroit. And I agree with the mayor that EAA needs to get folded back into DPS. If we're going to have a school district, then let's have a holistic school district. And charter schools are an entity that are not going away, so we need to effectively address them as well.
Very quickly, Keith, we have just a few seconds here. You are retired Detroit Federation of Teachers president. Do you think you're going to have a role here in the future? Do you have anybody's ear?
I have a lot of people's ear, and I would like to think it's because of the respect that I garnered in my 22 years in union leadership and my 36 years as an educator. I don't want a position like a job, but I do want to and am willing to lend my expertise and my knowledge in order to help facilitate the best learning and teaching opportunity for our children and teachers in Detroit.
Well, as we watch this great resurgence of the city of Detroit, the great city of Detroit, one of its sincere and deepest, most profound problems remains the Detroit public school system educating its kids. Let's hope for a solution sometime soon. Our guest, Keith Johnson, retired Detroit Federation of Teachers president. Thank you, Keith. I know we'll talk with you again. A lot of us go on vacation and dream, wow, what would it be like to live here and work here? I know I certainly did that growing up and spending every summer in Traverse City, or a good portion of the summer in Traverse City. Well, it turns out that Traverse City might not be such an easy place to live and work. And joining us on our line is Sarah Lucas, the Regional Planning Department Manager for Networks Northwest, to talk a little bit about the changing scene in Traverse City, beautiful Traverse City, and what it means to people who are trying to live and work there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And Rochelle Riley is on assignment this week. We're sorry to say she loves Traverse City, I think, as much as I do. Sarah, tell us a little bit about what it's like for let's talk about millennials, for one, moving into the Traverse City area. You know, it always seems so vibrant and vital, I should say, when mm-hmm. you're there in the middle of the summer. But what's it like to really live and work there?
Well, it's a great place to live and work. I live in Traverse City and love it. But for people who are moving into Traverse City, if they're coming up for a job, which is increasingly the case as our economy is picking up, they're really struggling to find places that they can afford to live. So we do have, a really vibrant community. There's a lot going on downtown. But a lot of the people that are actually working downtown and throughout the community are driving in many cases from outside of Traverse City because they can't find something they can afford near their work.
And, of course, that adds to the expense because if you're having a long commute in a vehicle, then you're looking at more expense.
Absolutely. And we really try to talk about housing in the context of transportation because housing and transportation together are your two biggest household costs. And in the Northwest Michigan region and in the Traverse City region, transportation costs, because people are so often living very far away from where they work, can actually rival the cost of housing. So the benchmark for affordability when we talk about housing is it shouldn't cost more than 30% of your income. And when you add in transportation, you shouldn't be spending more than 45% of your income on the combined cost of housing and transportation. But in the Traverse City area, people are spending upwards of 60% of their income on those two costs alone.
Oh, wow. And the
farther you get from Traverse City, the more those costs go up. So we have a lot of families that are paying, three-quarters of their income just on housing and transportation.
Who are the biggest employers in Traverse City? Do you happen to know that?
A few of them are, Munson Medical Center, the hospital, the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. They run the casinos there. Those are two real big employers. We have a lot of retail activity, and so some of, places like Cherry Republic are big employers in some communities. But Munson and the Grand Traverse Resort, I think, are two of the big ones.
And you work for Networks Northwest. You're a Traverse-based company that assists workforce and business development in 10 counties in that area. So when you've got young people moving into the area to take some of these jobs, how do you assist them in kind of overcoming some of these obstacles?
Well, unfortunately, our organization actually doesn't offer any housing programs. There are a lot of organizations in Traverse City that do. So places like the Traverse City Housing Commission or the Northwest Michigan Community Action Agency, some of them have programs where, they can help with vouchers that will subsidize rents for some individuals. But because there's such a huge demand for housing and particularly rental housing, those vouchers are hard to come by. But even more hard to come by is actual rental housing. So it sometimes will actually often happens that people will get a voucher to help with rent, but they can't find a rental to actually use it on.
This past summer, we did an interview with someone in Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids, I think, was named the third best economy in the country. And, of course, it's just another great area it's just so much growth, so much economic growth in that area. But they seem to have hit that right stride or the balance between new job development and then folding in the people that are coming in to the region into the communities. So what is the city of Traverse City doing to help address this problem? Are you seeing them step up and trying to address it?
Well, I think there's definitely a lot of interest and a lot of efforts around it. Everyone really recognizes that it's an issue because our businesses are so heavily impacted by it. So there's a lot of talk about how to address this. And Traverse City is kind of in a difficult spot when you're talking about, you know, the city itself, because there's very little room to develop. There's not a lot of undeveloped space in the city, and so then you have to talk about, you know, redeveloping properties to build more housing. So we have a lot of conversations, and you know, there's been some progress on doing things like changing zoning so that we can get you know, more housing within the city limits, and so that it's, you know, easier and smoother for developers who are trying to build that. So that's one thing that we've talked a lot about in Traverse City. Another thing that's come up is the idea of a housing trust fund. Mm-hmm. We actually have one in Grand Traverse County, and that would provide some, you know, local funding for development projects that include housing that meets local needs. So, you know, people are definitely making different types of efforts throughout the region to address housing, but it's really going to take a lot of different types of activities to make it work. The other really big thing is that we have to be able to attract private investment and private developers to actually create more housing. And that's, you know, something that's been happening, and there's more developments cropping up here and there. But a lot of times they run into challenges, you know, whether it's zoning or financing or the cost of the land, making the development unaffordable. Or, you know, in some cases, there's actually a lot of public opposition to bigger housing projects that are more dense.
We're talking to Sarah Lucas, the Regional Planning Department Manager at Networks Northwest in Traverse City. What's the weather like there today?
I'm actually in Detroit today.
Oh, darn. Okay. All right.
It's beautiful here.
Yeah, though. It is beautiful. We've had a string of really great days. Let's talk a little bit about wages. I mean, back in the day, I'm sure you might cringe when I say this, but back in the day, the saying always was, half your pay for a view of the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And that still may be the case where people say that. But, you know, wages are a key component in this whole story and in the development of the area. What are wages starting to rise a little bit in the region?
They are. I think wages are competitive, but they have to be considered in the context of living costs, and that's, you know, where we run into difficulties. A lot of, you know, not just Traverse City, but a lot of the communities around it are very, you know, seasonal, service-based economies where, you know, we have a big influx of seasonal workers, and they're earning service job wages, which are generally lower, and it's just not enough to cover the cost of basic living expenses for a lot of people.
If someone's considering a job coming up to Traverse City, what do you think the number one question they need to ask their future employer?
Well, actually, housing is one of the first questions that come up on both sides of the interview process. You know, and employers will ask people that they're interviewing if they have housing or if they're able to find it. And that's one of the first things that people think about when they think about moving to Traverse City, is where actually they're going to live.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy answer for either.
Well, we hope that the problem gets solved soon. Traverse City, of course, one of the greatest places on the planet, is, if you ask me, on my list.
Oh, I think so, too.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Sarah Lucas, thank you so much for joining us here on In the Mix. We appreciate your time. Welcome back to In the Mix. Back in August, we had the chance to talk with local TV news reporter and anchor at Fox 2, Roop Raj, about a very magical journey that he took to India and a cashmere scarf. We talk a lot about traveling on In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle, and once again, Rochelle is off this week, so flying solo here, if you will, for In the Mix this week. Traveling, we talk a lot about it on the show, but there's a unique aspect of traveling if you yourself have a background in a particular culture or in a particular country. Roop Raj is a news anchor and a reporter for WJBK Fox 2 here in Detroit. And Roop is joining us on the line. Hello, Roop.
Hey there, Marie. Good to be with you today.
I'm really glad you could join us. You have an article published in an online publication. The Think Club is the online publication, by the way. Travelogue, The Cashmere Scarf. And you wrote an article for this publication, and I thought it was really delightful when I read it. And you talk about your travels in India. And you, like me, are first generation. You're first generation Indian. I'm first generation Italian. And you and I have talked before about how that gives us such a unique perspective because I don't know about you, but sometimes it feels like I have one foot in one culture and one foot in another culture. Do you feel that way as well?
I always have felt that way. And I think that, you know, at first I would look at that as a disadvantage because I felt uneasy sometimes when, you know, talking to my American friends, so to speak, out in Troy growing up about what it was like to have Indian relatives or to travel to India or to have a different language spoken at home. And you kind of felt like maybe they looked at you like you were different. And they were right. You are. But those differences are actually quite special and quite awesome.
And and an advantage. But I like you, when I was growing up, it was, it was not in a day when cultures were celebrated at all. I grew up in a multicultural neighborhood. There were a lot of Ukrainians, a lot of Germans, people speaking their native languages at home, as we did at home. But it was still, you know, in high school, that was just considered weird in a lot of ways. And it took a long time before I realized that it was really a wonderful perspective and a great way to look at the world. And now you wrote about traveling back to India recently and this journey you went on to buy a scarf for your wife. So I want you to walk through that whole process with our listeners. Tell us when you went back to India and just a little bit about the experience there. I understand you still have family there.
I do. In fact, I went back there for a wedding and it was my cousin's wedding. I, you know, was born and brought up in America, grew up in Troy, had been to India two other times, but I was a kid. And this was the first time going back really as an adult. And when I went back, I was just, it is a life-changing experience to go back not only to a different country and see how people live and think differently than you do, but it also is life-changing on a different level. It's when you know that your dad and mom came from this place. And that's a pretty special connection. I think, Marie, you probably would agree, when you go back to the native place where your mom and dad, I mean, where they got married, the house they got married out of.
Yeah,
where my dad grew up. All of that stuff, to go see that before the wedding was incredible. But Marie, what happened was I went to go buy a cashmere scarf for my wife because cashmere actually comes from the word Kashmir, which is a place in India.
What city was this in?
So this is in a suburb of New Delhi called Gurgaon. I would like to say, like, if you're talking about Detroit being like New Delhi, it would be like heading into Hamtramck.
Okay, like a little enclave.
But if you just go like a block down the road and you look and there's this little scarf shop. So I walked in to go buy a scarf, and I walked in, and it was interesting because the guy there was bent on satisfying this tourist's needs. He was like, "What colors do your wife like?" There was a sea of just cashmere sitting in the middle of his table. He kept throwing them out in front of me, red, purple, green, all the different shapes, sizes, and patterns. And he could tell I didn't like what I saw. And so he instantly tells me, "Let's go across the street." And so I'm thinking he's taking me to a place that maybe is his, you know, one of his friends or relatives,
right.
Another shop that he owns. Marie, he was heading to his direct competitor's shop because he drug me in there and he said in Hindi, which is the native language in India, he said to the other guy, "Hey, man, this guy's from America. He wants to buy a scarf for his wife. He doesn't like the one in my shop. Would you mind treating him to some stuff from your shop?" And he looked at me and said, "I think you're going to be happier here." I said, "Is this your brother? Is this your friend? Is this?" He says, "No, this is my competitor. But what good am I if you walk out of this country without the scarf that you wanted and you're not happy?" To me, it was almost this karmic sense, like, do the right thing, even if it means handing your business over to somebody else, and somehow it'll come back.
What a great story. Did you find the scarf?
We did. I found the scarf. My wife likes it, thank God.
I was just that was my next question. Does she like it? I'll take it if she doesn't, sight unseen.
Exactly. But you know, it's funny, Marie, you know, when you go to like the Ann Arbor Art Fair, you go to, you know, some of these other street fairs, Rochester and Ann Arbor, we have so many great ones. You know, someone will go to India and buy up like, you know, 15 different things there. and they'll put them up for the price that you know, it, rightfully so, when you ship that stuff, it's expensive. But it's
right.
just funny to me that that stuff is so marked up. When you go there, one of our dollars is 40 of theirs.
Right.
So you can get a really good bargain on, like, cool stuff. But more than anything, the biggest bargain I got was, you know, going on this trip to go see my cousin get married, and in the process, learn about how people think differently. And the great thing about America is we bring those cultures here. And back to your original point, Marie, you know, when we see people who are different than us, rather than just saying, well, that's un-American or not American, rather than thinking that way, it's such a beautiful thing to be able to say, actually, that is so American. Ukrainian American, Italian American, Indian American, all of that woven together in this, I guess, scarf, you know, together in a quilt, and we're all in it. And I know that's cliche, but honestly, Marie, if you look at what the beauty of this country is built on, it is the differences that make it so special, and some of them can be really colorful.
Right, and I also think, Rupin, our business, it gives us a special perspective on the news, certainly on immigration issues and things like that. We just have a different viewpoint or a different perspective on that, having lived that way, lived through that with our own parents. So let me ask you this. How you said you did, this has been the first time back for this wedding that you're traveled back there. I'm assuming you're going to travel back there again after having had this. You talk about in this article, again, in the Think Club article, an online publication, you just talked about how rich this trip was and how much of an exchange you had with your family. Do you plan other trips back?
I definitely do. I think I want to take my wife, Julie, there as well, and she definitely wants to as well. You know, every single day that we would FaceTime at the odd hours, because they're 10 and a half hours ahead of us, I would FaceTime at the end of the day, and it was morning in America, and she would just listen to these stories. She's compelled to come with me. And the thing is, it's not just, you know, like her people originally are from Germany and Italy. You know, I think taking these trips to places where all of us are originally from, whether or not our parents came from there or not, it tells a story about who we are in a way that you can't really discover unless you show up there. And then you notice the qualities that people have and you go, wait a minute, that's something that I picked up on. That's kind of how I am. And whether you're German, Italian, Ukrainian, Indian, whatever the culture be, it's so special to go back to a place and say, man, this is where it all started.
Once again, the name of the article is called The Kashmir Scarf by Roop Raj, and he, of course, the news anchor and reporter at Fox 2 here in Detroit. Roop, thank you so much for just a delightful little slice of life. We hope to see you on TV soon.
Well, Marie, I just want to say congratulations on your new venture here at WJR. It's incredible to hear your voice again, and I think I speak for all of Detroit when we say you are such a wonderful voice for all of us to have in our cars and in our living rooms. So thank you for coming back.
You're too kind, Roop. Thank you so much. We're going to talk soon because I know we have an event coming up in September, so we'll be talking again soon.
See you then, my friend.
In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle. Sponsored by the Michigan Center for Fertility and Women's Health. Here's Marie Osborne.
This past week, the city of Detroit and, frankly, activists around the world lost one of their true leaders, Grace Lee Boggs, died on Monday here in Detroit at the age of 100. She left a legacy that was far and wide, not just here in the Detroit area, but worldwide. And you really couldn't pick up a newspaper this week or listen to any kind of radio broadcast or television broadcast without someone noting her passing. Joining us is Ron Scott, founder of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. Ron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, good morning. I'm also a member of the Boggs Center Board.
Oh, the Boggs Center Board. Very good. Ron, you described her in one word, grace. So tell us why you described Grace Lee Boggs with that one word.
Well, in terms of my growing up as a young person, growing up in church, grace represents a metaphor and a reality in terms of all of the intrinsic spiritual focus of loving and focusing on humanity, and also the strident presence that gives one the strength to go ahead and do the work that needs to be done to transform humanity. And in our last statements, the whole question was in terms of respiriting the souls of people and changing the nature of a circumstance from just a hard material framework that a lot of activists have done to and changing it to a question of dialectical humanism. That is, looking at how humans have developed over the past 500-600 years to be where we are, and looking at a new paradigm for America. Not an America that's based on confrontation all the time, but a revolution of values, just like Dr. King talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So, in effect, Grace challenged a lot of people who used the mad perspective or the anger perspective, not that that's not worthy sometimes, into a situation of building relationships across race, gender, and class.
And talk about an unlikely success story, but it's truly an American success story. Boggs was born in 1915 in Rhode Island, the child of Chinese immigrants, grew up in New York City. Her father owned a Chinese restaurant on Broadway. And what most impressed me was her deep intelligence. She really, bar none, she won a scholarship to Barnard College for undergrad students. And I understand she went to college at the age of 16. Is that true?
Yes, she did. And she graduated and got her PhD in 1938.
And this was when women had just barely received the right to vote. And here she
is
getting...
This is when Chinese babies, the girls in China and other places, were having their heads bashed against the wall and killed because they didn't want girl children to be born.
Right. Right. I mean, she just exemplifies how her deep intelligence and her, you know, her ability to just break barriers, even at the age of 16. When did you first meet her?
I met Grace in 1968. I was just a young activist myself. I met she and Jamie. And you have to know about she and James Boggs, because here it is, a woman and got a scholarship to Barnard, graduated, and got a PhD in 1938. And then you have James Boggs, who came from rural Alabama and was a factory worker and became an intellectual part nun. The two of them married, got together, one black, one Chinese, one rural, one urban. And I'm telling you, Marie, you would love to have heard some of the arguments, discussions, because it was fantastic just sitting there. It wasn't, you know, they argued politically. They didn't agree, but they had a wonderful relationship. And that's what produced some of the political developments. We talked about, like, looking at urban rebellion and following the 67 rebellion.
Right.
Coming up with the term, nobody knows that. They came up with the term underclass. Other things like that.
Wow, I did not know that. So they came up with the term underclass, which is now, of course, so accepted in public discourse when we talk about activism and civil rights. Tell me about her life here in Detroit. I know she came here in the 1950s. Is that correct? She came with her
husband?
Yeah,
early 1950s.
All right, so tell me about her life here in Detroit.
Well, from the time that she got here, she had been involved in left politics and so forth in Chicago. She lived and learned a lot about that from the early 1940s and lived in the black community, because in that particular time, obviously, Chinese were considered African-American or less, you know, than white. But she meandered through that, worked in the political activities, came here in the 1950s, met James Boggs about the same time, and the two worked in a couple of political organizations, which they left, and then they formed and worked with organizations like Group on Advanced Leadership, worked with people like that you might know, like Milton Henry and others, in terms of dealing with the segregated facilities in city of Detroit, getting African-Americans jobs and banks and so forth. And those are the kinds of things that she did through the 1950s. In the 1960s, they obviously were at the forefront of the burgeoning 60s revolution, the urban revolution, I might mention. And that Grace was one of the last members of the group that formed the Message to the Grassroots Conference, where Malcolm X spoke. She and Malcolm X were good friends. She's one of the last ones that was living.
Yeah.
To be involved in that.
And she also tried to get him to run for Senate, right, Malcolm X?
Yes. Yes, she did.
I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that room.
Oh, well, Marie, if I could do my best Grace impression, she would say, "Now, Malcolm, you have to do something to challenge the people to move ahead. You have a great persona. You should do that."
And the Academy Award goes to Ron Scott. Oh, that's excellent. And also, all this activity with her and her husband gained her a substantial FBI file during the McCarthy era, of course, along with many others, we should say. But that didn't deter her. She pursued and she persevered.
Grace believes in Jimmy and Grace Boggs. We're two of the first people who actually challenged young radicals not to dismiss America, but to embrace America, is that America still is one of the best hopes for a revolutionary change, and that we should do that. We should love the country for its possibilities, not for its errant behavior. And so as a result of that, she welcomed that. She wasn't concerned about that. Those people were the people who were trying to move backwards. She was moving forward. And I should answer that Grace and James Boggs created the whole focus in terms of development of agriculture, urban agriculture, and urban farming. That was one of their first things. They also are responsible for small bakeries like Avalon International Breads. That was their suggestion for creating small business in Detroit. So every time you eat a roll at Avalon International Bridge, think about Grace and James Bond.
I will. That's one of my favorite places on the planet.
Right.
Well, Ron
right.
Scott, just once again to review something you said, I'd read about it, but you said it so well, that Grace Lee Boggs took these young radicals and told them not to dismiss America, but to embrace America. And boy, could we use her now, the way we see public, political discourse going in this country. That's just a wonderful, wonderful way to say it, not to dismiss America, but to embrace it and see change from within. Thank you so much for offering us this wonderful picture of Grace Lee Boggs, this person that we read about and hear about, but you brought her really to life for us today, Ron. We really want to thank you for your time.
I loved her, and I loved every argument we ever had.
Remember to keep in touch with us here on In the Mix. We're on Facebook, of course, and In the Mix at WJR@gmail.com is our email. If you have any thoughts or ideas, we'd love to hear from you. Rochelle off this week on assignment. We will see her again next week. And our thanks today to Mark Blackwell, our technical producer, Laura Hessen, our producer. Remember, this is conversation you care about right here on WJR In the Mix with Marie and Rochelle.